the big holdout in the Paris climate talks may be the country with the most at stake, economically, that is. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood. Kai Rizdahl is on assignment. It's Tuesday, the first day of December, and I'm glad to be here. We'll start off today in Paris on day two of the big climate summit there. This is the day where negotiators sent home the heads of state and got down to the real business. That business boils down to one question. Who's going to pay for the transition off fossil fuels and even the damage caused by climate change? Today, the world's poorest countries made the case that the rich world needs to pay that bill. The face of the argument is perhaps the most important country at the Paris talks, India. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
India will soon be the biggest importer of coal and the largest source of new demand for oil. Post where America used to be that country, but India, population-wise, is four Americas. Economist Michael Greenstone at the University of Chicago spoke from New Delhi.
The state of Bihar, which is home to 100 million people, per capita electricity consumption is about 200 kilowatt hours per person per year. In the U.S., so it's about 65 times higher.
Thing is, India is already the third biggest emitter of carbon dioxide. And as its people plug in, even the most ambitious solar program will still require lots of coal-fired power. So India's emissions, even under its pledge, could double. Varun Sivaram at the Council on Foreign Relations, also in Delhi, calls this a growth climate paradox.
It is now India's time to be in the ascendancy. But with this growth is going to come domestic problems like air pollution and congestion, as well as international problems like climate change.
In Paris, India wants the rich countries to put up $100 billion to help developing countries build a low-carbon future. And when the money and technology come, then India will consider more emissions cuts, says Richie Ahuja of the Environmental Defense Fund's office in India.
The challenge with India is India cannot afford to play with what's over the horizon. It has got so many urgent here and now problems that it will ratchet up ambition as it can see the horizon.
And ratcheting up ambitions of India and every other country is a top-line goal in Paris. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Drug prices are something of a flashpoint topic in recent weeks, thanks to dramatic price hikes, like when Turing Pharmaceuticals jacked up the price of a pill often used by HIV patients and pregnant women from $13.50 to $750 a dose. Well, today, Express Scripts, which purchases drugs for insurers and large employers, says it will work with a different pharmaceutical firm to make a generic version of that same drug for a dollar a pill. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein explains why this may be a tipping point in drug prices.
Not many Americans take the 50-year-old drug Daraprim, maybe 2,000 people a year. But for those who need it, says Express Scripts' Dr. Steve Miller, the price hike was a sock to the jaw.
It's an enormous challenge to cover the medicine.
Turing's move made national headlines and immediately shoved the entire pharmaceutical industry under the microscope. Miller says for decades, insurers and employers have basically had to swallow whatever prices pharma spooned out. What's important about today is that rather than pay that price, Express Scripts sought out a partner to make an alternative drug cheaper.
This is a message to them that the marketplace will respond and will be creative in finding solutions.
University of Chicago economist Rena Conti says perhaps the bigger lesson here is what a little competition can do.
For generic drugs that have experienced price spikes, one easy way to get prices to come down is to simply allow more suppliers into the market.
Express Scripts' action may be a signal to pharma, but industry consultant Adam Fine hopes regulators in Washington are paying attention.
If the FDA clears the 4,000 generic drug applications it has backlogged, then you will see the price of generic drugs drop.
And if that happens, says Fine, then the strategy Turing employed, increasing prices 50-fold, won't be happening much anymore. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, markets got the month off to a holly green start. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The huge hack of Hong Kong toy company VTech continues to spread. VTech said today that hackers stole information of nearly 6.5 million children who used its toys. That number is up from 200,000, which is how many kids the company said were affected when it announced the hack on Friday. Hackers also grabbed the data on about 5 million of the kids' parents. The children's stolen information includes names and birth dates, and it may include photos and chat logs from VTech's toy tablets and their parents' phones. For more, here's Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech and the new podcast Codebreaker. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Molly.
How could someone use this data? Because other than the extremely high creepy factor, kids' data doesn't really have much value, right?
Well, it doesn't yet, Molly. And there is a scare factor here. But your average kid doesn't have a credit card, right? Here's something to remember, though. It's what several security researchers have said to me in the past. A lot of these kinds of hacks can be incremental and build towards a kind of data profile over time that becomes a real problem for a person. So you get a kid's name and address in a toy hack. Maybe later that name gets matched to an actual physical address, then maybe a social security number and another hack further down. Eventually, hackers can build a more permanent data profile on a person that doesn't change, like a password can be changed, and thus becomes useful further down the line and a real problem.
And does this feel like a bit of a shift? I mean, I sort of would have thought that maybe children's data would be off limits. Does this feel like a watershed moment? And I mean, cyber attacks have become so common, but somehow this one seems extra shocking.
Yeah, it does feel shocking, Molly. And in part, that is because we are starting to see the edge of something that people have been talking about for a while, which is the Internet of Things and the fact that so many of the things that we use, including toys, Molly, are going to be connected devices. And it's the beginning of a problem that I don't think is going away for a long time.
And isn't it something parents should be aware of as they're shopping for the holidays this year? I think that casual Internet connection. I mean, really, that casual Internet connection is everywhere. Like, maybe we need to go back to, you know, Legos and
no, Legos will always be huge, Molly, of course. But I do think that one thing that parents should be thinking about as they buy connected toys is, what is the data that's being asked for when you give your child a connected toy? And just think about it a little bit. Think about how you use your data. Think about what kind of data you're inputting into this connected toy. And I think all of us should be thinking about that. I know security researchers and hackers are already thinking about this, so we should too as users.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and the brand new Codebreaker podcast, which you should check out immediately. Thanks a lot, Ben.
Thank you, Molly.
A big merger this week wants to get you where you sleep. Retailer Mattress Firm is paying $780 million for Sleepies. If approved, the combined company will have 3,500 retail stores nationwide, plus various online sites and distribution centers. The companies hope the merger will help cement the dominance of Big Mattress, the industry. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has more.
A dominant factor in this deal is what drives almost every merger. Getting bigger makes it possible to increase profits by cutting costs and getting higher prices. But there's also something else going on here. Listen to what Mattress Firm President Ken Murphy told me this afternoon about the deal.
The thing ultimately that gives us confidence about our robust, not only offline, but now online platform is the ability to provide that same great comfort of service and confidence, whether you're purchasing online or offline.
Part of what's going on is concern about new competition from online bed-in-a-box delivery companies, and the Sleepy's merger should make Mattress Firm distribution more efficient. But these legacy companies also want to get bigger and more powerful because you, the would-be mattress buyer, are more powerful than you used to be. Think about the last time you bought a mattress.
I ended up going to one of the mattress stores I had used before, rolled around on a few of the beds, tried to see which ones were most comfortable, and placed my order.
Wharton professor Dave Riebstein bought his mattress the way most people do, in a store. But it hasn't been easy to tell whether you're getting a good deal, because mattress sellers offer a dizzying array of choices and prices. All this has opened the door for them to charge us more. But these days, we have better access to expertise online. Jerry Kim teaches strategy at Columbia Business School.
Now that consumers are a little more empowered with information, these online reviews, the landscape of power between consumers and retailers has shifted.
We can drive a harder bargain, and that's part of why a big mattress retailer feels the need to bulk up. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Sometimes they come and they talk about it in the salon, or I hear it around like friends and stuff that they're waiting for 11, 10 years, 9 years.
The long, long wait for affordable housing in the U.S. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 168 points, 0.9%, to close at 17,888. The NASDAQ grew 47 points, 0.9%, to finish at 5156. And the S&P 500 rose 22 points, 1%, to end at 2102. We told you about that big mattress merger. Mattress firm bounced 6.9% on the news that it's buying Sleepy's. Mattress manufacturer Tempur Sealy adjusted up 1.5%. The pharmacy benefits company Express Scripts, which we also told you about earlier in the show, delivered 1.5% on news that it's covering a $1 treatment for a deadly parasitic disease. That treatment's maker, Imprimis Pharmaceuticals, boosted 10.5%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.14%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Senate Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry Committee holds a hearing on agriculture's role in combating global hunger. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to issue its Beige Book Summary of Commentary on Current Economic Conditions, the last one of 2015. And new U.S. Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, lights the Capitol Christmas tree. While in New York City, the Rockefeller Center Christmas tree lighting ceremony takes place. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Molly Wood. Earlier this month, the European Union reported a backlog of nearly 800,000 applications for asylum and said it would take a year to clear. Now, here in the United States, a year is a hopeful estimate. In Los Angeles, for example, officials interviewed people just last month who applied for asylum in August of 2011. The interview is just one step in the multi-part screening that puts lots of applicants in financial and legal limbo. One person working her way through the process is a 27-year-old Syrian who came here for school.
My name is Manal Ilyas. I'm from Syria, but I was born and raised in Dubai. So I came to the U.S. in August 2013 to do a master in filmmaking. So I was thinking about filing for asylum when I first came here because I knew I didn't want to go back to the Middle East. And so I put in all my savings, basically, with the lawyer who is a very good lawyer in L.A. and who specializes in asylum. And then I filed in March. My lawyer is very honest, so surprisingly. So he told me, Manal, there's no guarantee. You can get a call for the interview in 5 months. You can get a call in 2 years, in 5 years. It's definitely a gray area in every aspect you can imagine. So, for example, when I went to buy a car, I mean, I can't tell you how many dealerships I went to. One of them, the guy actually went to run my credit, and he came. He's like, you have no score. Well, I can't do anything with you. You have no score. I mean, I knew that I had to start building credit, so I got these two credit cards, and I was like, ooh, as long as I use them and I pay on time, I'm good. But, like, I had nothing. I was too fresh. So that applies to, for example, I want to move out. That applies to looking for a new apartment as well because, you know, looking into my credit, how long I'm going to be in the country, all this stuff is unclear. But I love the U.S., honestly, and I think it's full of opportunities. It's just a matter of being hungry for it because a lot of people are hungry. Professionally, you know, I would like to be self-employed. I would like to have my own creative agency. You know, besides doing design for the next couple of years, I have this image in my head where I own this, like, really cute, beautiful house on a piece of land, and I grow my own food, and my grandchildren are running around me, and I'm this really pretty farmland place, you know, typical American landscape. That's my American dream.
That story was produced by Caitlin Esch. All across this big country, there is an equally big shortage of affordable housing. And in around 2 in 5 rental households, people are spending at least a third of their income on rent. And that is the official definition of rent burdened. Now, there is a federal government program meant to help with that burden. It's commonly called Section 8. It basically means the government pays a portion of your rent. More than 2 million households get Section 8 vouchers. And that sounds like a lot, but the waiting lists to get them are even longer. From our Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Noel King has the story.
Mary Laney Marrero is a hairstylist in Yonkers, New York. She's 37 years old. For the past few years, she's bounced from apartment to apartment, and in that time, there's one thing she's held on to very tightly, a letter from the Yonkers Housing Authority.
This says, Dear applicant, we write to advise you that your application was one of over 11,000 preliminary applications that our housing authority received between January 23, 2012 and January 30, 2012.
3.5 years ago, Yonkers opened up its Section 8 waiting list. In a single week, 11,000 people called a hotline and applied. To qualify for Section 8, your income must be below a line that is set by the federal government. The line is based on the median income of the area in which you live. Marrero, like all applicants, has no idea where she sits on the list, but from what she's heard, a 3.5-year wait isn't an especially long one.
Sometimes they come and they talk about it in the salon, or I hear it around like friends and stuff, that they're waiting for 11, 10 years, 9 years.
She earns around $25,000 a year. Recently, she's been renting a room in the home of one of her customers from the salon. She pays $500 a month. She used to rent an apartment of her own, but then a few years ago, she started working at a new salon, lost most of her regular clients, and at the same time, the economy got bad. She couldn't pay the rent.
There's no money out there.
How does it trickle down to you?
Well, people who used to go and get a wash and set every single week, now they wait 3 weeks. To get a wash and set.
How much does a wash and set cost?
$20. People used to tip you $5. Now they give you $3.
She works 6 days a week and cannot afford an apartment. John Schenk is Special Projects Coordinator at the Housing Resource Center at Cluster, a community-based service organization in Yonkers. He knows Mary Laney and says her story is only one of 11,000.
It's torturous for us to help people apply and know that the only reason why they're waiting is they're waiting for a limited resource that they're eminently qualifying for.
Schenk says, unlike Mary Laney, many people don't have a decent place to live.
While waiting, what are they doing? They're paying 50, 60% of their income towards rent, oftentimes for housing that is substandard, old, run down, and they are doubling up or more with family, friends, or others.
In most places across the country, Section 8 waiting lists are rarely open. When they do open, it's for a small window of time, and the numbers are daunting. New Orleans last opened its waiting list in 2009. There are about 20,000 families on it. Chicago opened its wait list last year and added 50,000 families. Austin, Texas also opened its wait list last year and collected 19,000 applications in 8 days. 10,000 people applied in the first day. Joseph Schuldiner is the executive director of the Municipal Housing Authority in Yonkers. That's the agency that sent Mary Laney Marrero her letter 3.5 years ago. He's also run some of the country's largest housing authorities, New York City, Chicago, Los Angeles, so he's familiar with shortages. He says nationwide, only about a quarter of people who are low income enough to qualify for a voucher actually hold a voucher.
It's done by Congress. Congress says, here's how much money you have. You know, when Congress says, you know, this program gets $3 billion and the average cost of a voucher is whatever, and you divide into it, well, that's how many vouchers you have.
And there is really only one path to get a voucher.
We're only able to award a voucher when someone who has one leaves the program. That is only 25 to 30 a month, maybe 300 plus a year. So, you know, 11,000 is theoretically close to a 40-year waiting list.
And that number, 11,000 people in Yonkers, that was in 2012. Most housing officials and housing advocates say they have no doubt that in the years between when a list is open and when it finally opens again, there are thousands more households that would be qualified to get on the list if only they could. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Over now to sports. The Golden State Warriors are off to a history-making start. They have the most wins at the start of a season ever in the NBA. They're 19-0. The Warriors play again tomorrow night, and if they go 20-0, they'll tie a 131-year-old record for the longest season-opening winning streak by any professional sports team. That record was set by the St. Louis Maroons baseball team in 1884. You can take that to Sports Trivia Night. But what do these streaks in sports really mean? You know, in the show me the money sense. I asked Kenneth Shropshire of the Wharton Sports Business Initiative. Hey, Kenneth, how are you?
Great. How are you?
Good. In fact, I'm feeling good because I live in Oakland. So the Warriors, obviously, on this big winning streak, the best start to a season in NBA history. Why, other than fans really liking it, why is this such a big deal?
Well, you know, brand, I think, is the key thing in the end. That you think of the great win streaks of the past, is it really established the brand of some great teams, the University of Oklahoma football team being undefeated in the 50s, the Miami Dolphins, the UCLA Bruins. I mean, so the image just stays with you that teams have these successful winning streaks.
Is there an impact then, like a long-term impact that can be measured? Does it move more merchandise or get better sponsorships for that team in the long run?
We think it can, I mean, especially in the short run, especially as attendance increases and people want to be identified with a team. It's a lot like an appearance in the World Series or a championship or something like that. People want to say, I am part of this team. Bigger than that, though, is, as I said, the brand, that it sticks with a team, that they are the team that had that special streak. And so, you know, the Warriors will forever be identified as having this streak at the beginning of the season, which is sort of unique in professional sports to win from the beginning.
Where else does this bring in money? Are people making more bets on the Warriors, betting on the opposing teams more?
Well, you know, I think the other place, it certainly can happen there too, and kind of trying to guess and bet on when the loss is going to take place. But in television ratings, in that realm, and the idea that the media companies are able to, you think about when the Miami Heat was having a pretty good run, the advertising dollars were on the upswing because people wanted to see if a streak continued. They want to see if the Lakers streak gets broken.
Well, and you brought up TV, which was where I was going to go next. Mm-hmm. Those games certainly, I would assume, get more valuable. And the NBA has the ability, right, to flex games and bump them to national TV. How does that affect the teams that got bumped?
Well, certainly you don't want to be the team that gets bumped. And I think people understand now with things like Monday Night Football, Sunday Night Football, that's special for athletes to be televised, to be the team that's in that spotlight game. But it's also important to athletes to just be on more often in general. It really is impactful for them. That's what they do. That's what they live for, is to have their image out there for people to be able to see them play. So, you know, for the Warriors, it's a good thing. For the teams that I sit here in Philadelphia, the Sixers, where, you know, maybe only a few people have seen the team with the opposite streak going this year, it's not such a good thing.
That's Kenneth Shropshire from the Wharton Sports Business Initiative. Thanks so much for coming on, Kenneth.
Thank you. Take care.
And this final note before we go, Dr. Priscilla Chan had her baby daughter today. Her name is Max, and Priscilla and her husband, Mark Zuckerberg, announced the birth on Facebook, obviously. It was not just your average baby announcement, though. In the note to baby Max, the couple also pledged to give away 99% of their Facebook shares in their lifetime to, quote, advance human potential and promote equality for all children in the next generation. Those shares, by the way, are currently worth about $45 billion. Zuckerberg also made a second announcement in an SEC filing via Facebook, which said, quote, Mr. Zuckerberg has established a new entity, the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative LLC, and he will control the voting and disposition of any shares held by such entity. The filing noted that Zuckerberg will not give away more than $1 billion per year over the next 3 years. It's very sensible. Zuckerberg is taking 2 months of paternity leave, by the way. And that is our program. Today, the Dow climbed 168 points, 0.9%. The NASDAQ grew 47 points, 0.9%. And the S&P 500 rose 22 points. That was not 0.9%. It was 1%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. And the senior digital producer is Nishat Kirwa. I am Molly Wood. Marketplace will be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.